യോന്തപ്രവിശ്യമമവാചമിമാം പ്രസുപ്തം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖിലശക്തിധരസ്വധാമ്ന അന്യാംശ്ച ഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വഗാദീൻ പ്രാണാൻ നമോ ഭഗവതേ പുരുഷായ ലഭ്യം. സോ ടുഡേസ് ടോപ്പിക് ഈസ് ദ ഹിം ഓഫ് ക്രിയേഷൻ ഫ്രം ദ വേദസ്. ഇൻസിഡൻ്റലി ഇറ്റ് ഈസ് വൺ ഓഫ് ദി മോസ്റ്റ് പ്രൊഫൗണ്ട് spiritually and philosophically one of the most profound hymns in the entire Vedic literature. Now it just contains 7 verses, just 7 verses. Rigveda itself contains more than 10,000 verses divided into more than 1,000 hymns. Again, the whole text divided into 10 books, or what is called mandala. So to begin with, I can just present before you a recording of this hymn, which is traditionally as being taught through a succession of teachers and students for the last several thousands of years. So the recording is very interesting. So I can just present before you. So this is the beginning. Yeah. Now this war, it was a peace chant. Normally before every auspicious hymn, before they chant, they do this peace chant called Shanti Mantra. Now you begin the real hymn, which contains, as I mentioned, only 7 verses. So it's the beginning.
ശർമന്നം ഭക്തിമാസീദ്ഗഹനംഗഭീരം ന മൃത്യുരാസീദമൃതന്നതർഹി നരാത്ര അന്ന ആസീത് പ്രകേതഃ ആനീദവാതം സ്വധയാ തദേകം തസ്മാത് ധാന്യം ന പരഃ കിഞ്ചന തന്മഹിനാജായതൈകം കാമസ്തദഗ്രേ സമവർത്തതാധിമനസോരേതഃ പ്രഥമയ്യദാസീത് സതോ ബന്ധുമസതി നിരവിന്ദന് ഹൃദി പ്രതിശ്യാ സ്വധ അവസ്ഥ പ്രയതി പരസ്താ अयम् विसृष्टिः अर्वाग्देवा अस्य विसर्जने नाथ को वेदयत आबभूव इयम् विसृष्टिर्यत आबभूव यदि वा दधे यदि वा न यो अस्य दक्षः परमे व्यो मनसो अङ्गवे
So this is the hymn creation. Now you will be surprised that this is essentially the first human analysis of where are we coming from, what's the meaning of life, and what's the nature of this world. And what exactly is the significance of this human journey, the origin of the universe, and so on. I mean, we are all looking for answers, and it's very easy to find an answer in the form of some kind of creationist ideas. And mind you, the Vedic literature itself contains several descriptions, illustrations, depicting creationism, a God creating this world. There are certainly statements, but the most profound analysis of the ontology, the cosmology of the universe is found here. That's why, you know, it has attracted a very large body of literature, commentaries, both in Indian philosophy, and also when for the first time, when Western Indologists came to read this, they have been struck by the unique spiritual analysis. It begins by saying that in the beginning, there was neither non-existence, na asat asi. That's how it begins, na asat asi, no asat asi. In the beginning, there was no non-existence. In the sense, in the beginning, it was not something that was absolutely nothing. It was not non-existence. So, the possibility of the whole universe coming out of non-existence is ruled out. And then it says, Nasadasi, it's a kind of paradox you find. I mean, it's paradoxically, the hymn states, in the beginning there was not non-existence and there was not anything which you call existence. Paradoxically stating, the non-existent existed, not the non-existent existed. I mean, the non-existent did not exist. That means it was not non-existence. Nor did the existent exist. So that's why na asat asit na u sadasit. It's an ancient Sanskrit language. This Vedic Sanskrit language was formed at least 5,000, 4,000 years before Sanskrit grammar was standardized, and that happened in the 9th century BC. So that's how it begins. What it means, to give an example, to explain, you cannot argue that the world comes out of nothingness. But you cannot argue that this world comes out of something which can be empirically understood. So the word sat is used, the existent. It doesn't mean the absolute existence, but rather the relative empirical existence. It's called Vyavaharika Satta. So that's why the hymn goes on saying, at that time there was no sun, no moon, no day, no night. Nothing that you can enjoy or you can make use of. Everything was clouded in something which cannot be called existence in the empirical sense, in the worldly sense, or non-existent empirical sense. These mountains, valleys, all these did not exist. In that sense, there is no existence. But then, can all these come out of total, absolute non-existence? No. So, absolute non-existence also did not exist. So, you find the commentator Sayanacharya, which we are going to quote, says, the horn of a hair, even the expression itself contradicts its possibility. It's a logical fallacy to say that this is the horn of a hair. Like that, that's absolutely impossible even to conceive of. It is called total absolute non-existence. That absolute non-existence did not exist, which means the world doesn't come out of total absolute non-existence. When can this world come out of empirical things? No. So it comes out of something which we cannot empirically call existence or non-existence. That's why, you know, it goes on saying, there was no death and there was no deathlessness. Na murtyu asit amrutam na tarhi. Amrutam means deathlessness. There was no death. There was no deathlessness. Now, how do you explain? How do you try to describe something which cannot be described? We can make a statement, it cannot be described. There the battle is won over. But the sages cannot have that luxury of making a simple small statement expecting the whole world will understand. So a sage or a saint, a philosopher, has to resort to metaphors, figures of speech, illustrations, may have to write a whole volume to say that in the beginning there was no empirical non-existence or empirical existence. To write this, he has to write a very elaborate hymn. That's what the hymn is. That's why there was no moon, no sun. And then there was no day, no light. There was no enjoyment and there was no enjoyer. For your interest, not for my interest, because I know that most of the great Western intellectuals who are great admirers of this Vedic culture would like to hear what some other great Western admirers have said about this. That's why I'm quoting. The famous Carol Werner, he says, this idea depicted in this hymn is not derived from reasoning, but rather it comes from another source. You reach a point where you experience something which you know very well it's a fact. Nobody can shake your conviction. If it is something that you derive at through reasoning, then a greater logician, a greater philosopher can disprove you. You're wrong. Because logic is an advantage. Logic also is a great disadvantage. Even the best logician who puts forth the great truth can be disproved by a roguish philosopher, maybe more intelligent. So logic has this problem. Reasoning has this problem. It is a very inadequate and frequently very misleading tool and instrument. So that's why Carol Werner, who wrote elaborately on it, he says, it is not from reasoning. It comes from a visionary, mystical experience, what we call yogic experience. That is the Western way of trying to explain the transcendental experience. Vedantins, like Sayana, Vivekananda, Shankaracharya will put it, it's come from a transcendental spiritual experience. That's what it is. Another author, Burnton, he says, It's a gradual evolution of human understanding, human perception of what actually cannot be perceived at empirical level. I should explain this. You can understand many things through logic, through reasoning, through intellect, and through mind. As I mentioned earlier, all that you understand or all the convictions you get through reasoning and logic can always be demolished by another person using logic, who may be much more of an expert using the same tool as logic. So this is journey through experience. That's why in the beginning the verse begins na asadasi no sadasi tadanim. Then at that time there was neither existence nor non-existence. What existed was something which is beyond description in terms of existence, non-existent rather. And then ultimately, at one point of maybe the fourth mantra which we are going to discuss, I just want to give bird view. The sage slowly undertakes a journey, an evolutionary process, in the process of cognition, understanding, and spiritual evolution. And then finally, sato bentum asadi niravindan hridi pradishya kavayo manisha. You know, the way it was chanted is different in music. I'm putting in prose order. That's all. So, sataha bentum asadi niravind. Sat means this world. All that you see. The entire phenomenal world, empirical world. Bentum means the original cause. The cause of this empirical universe. Asadi niravintan. They came to understand that this universe cannot have come from something which is totally non-existent. From nothingness, it cannot come. So finally, their search came to an end where Hridi means in their own hearts. Hridi pradeshya kavayo manisha. So kavayaha mean mantra dashtara. Kavi is a word in Sanskrit language which has got many connotations. One word, one meaning is it is a wise person. Now wisdom has got a very philosophical sense. It is not understanding, it is not expertise, it is not efficiency, it is not intellectual precision, rather it is something that goes beyond all this, but which includes all this. Wisdom is that which helps you to handle what you know and to understand and to place the knowledge that you have got, what it actually implies, in what way this knowledge can be used and in what way cannot be used. That higher inner sense is called wisdom. So such people are called kavi. The simple meaning in modern Sanskrit, it means poet. A poet is not one who sits in a corner with a long beard and writes something listening to, maybe from collecting things from internet or YouTube. A poet is a person who goes to solitude and closes his eyes, not staring at the world, but staring at himself, which means closing the eyes. You can look into yourself only if you stop looking to the outside world. So such people are called kavayaha. Mantra drashtaraha kavayaha is a very famous definition. Mantra means the essential meaning of a word. The meaning comes from within. The one who realizes, who experiences this higher meaning by undertaking this journey into himself, into herself, and discovers the meaning within him. That is, such a person is called kavayaka or mantra dashtaraka. If you go deeper into the essence of modern science, technology, everything, sociology, anything you want, ultimately, what we write, what we speak, is what we experience with him. We cannot really expound or explain or actually write as our own words unless we connect the implication, the meaning of those words within our own hearts. So these sages went in search of the original cause of the universe, the meaning of life and existence, and finally they discovered within themselves. That is, asadobendum asadiniravindan kriti pradeshya kavayo manisha. That is the verse. Now I shall come to a very important central subject before entering the sutra proper, the sutta proper. So one important point to remember is, in the Vedantic literature, there are two fundamental views on creation, or what we call creation, on the origin of the universe and the origin of life. Technically, in Sanskrit language, is called Srishti Drishtivada and Drishti Srishtivada. So I shall explain this very simple language. The first one is, it means we see creation because it exists. We see that because it exists. The other one is, the creation exists because we see it. That is called Drishti Srishtivada. Drishti means seeing. So the first one is, we see this creation because it exists. So it exists independent of our cognition. Now this cannot strictly be true, because 8 billion people on this planet see 8 billion different lives, 8 billion different worlds. They live, they inhabit 8 billion different planets. In the higher sense, I don't mean the valleys, mountains are the same. But the way we see, even the Nepal forests, or coal, the iron ore, all this, the oceans, the mountains, valleys. Many people are concerned about keeping these wonderful gifts of nature pure, serene, unpolluted in their purity. For them, they are inhabiting a different planet. They see rivers and mountains and forests from a different angle. So it is their creation. That means that is the creation exists because we see it. Or creation exists as we see it. The world is our own creation. It is not subjective idealism of Berkeley or the Buddhist two schools, Sautrantika and Vaibhav. Mahayana Buddhism has got Vijnanavada. It's called Yogacara philosophy. Vijnanavada or Yogacara. It is little different. Because in Yogacara system or in Berkeley, not city Berkeley, I'm talking about the philosopher Berkeley, the exponent of subjective idealism. Now for them, all these things do not have any empirical reality. Passing phenomena. They don't know a reality. But Vedantins say the same thing, but they say they do have a reality, which is a reality which is not absolute, which is only relative. They are real in the relative sense. Now, the very concept of something being relatively true can be logically intelligible only when you posit something which is absolutely real. Relative reality can be logically understood only against the background of something which is not just relatively real, which is absolutely real. So there is something which is absolutely real, and that absolute reality exists in a very what we call avyakta state, unmanifest state. Unmanifested means devoid of names and forms. And that state is referred to Indinasadiya Suktam as the origin of the universe. So it is a very simple, it is not a very simple thing intellectually to understand, but it is the real truth. It is very easy to say that God one day created this world and, you know, he put different things, stars, planets, everything, different places, like a huge machine, and then he put his intelligence programmed into this huge machine, and the machine continues rolling on for the last 6,000 years. A very simple thing. You find something very similar in popular Hindu mythologies. But popular Hindu mythologies have no place in the context of Vedic, these Vedic hymns, because they are much more profound and rational. So you have to remember these are two different views. One is Srishti Drishtivada, which means in the beginning, we see creation the way it exists or because it exists. And Drishti Srishtivada means creation exists because we see it. So modern science and technology more or less are built upon this premise, this essential principle that there is a world for us to explore into. We have to find out its different aspects. So we have to make an inquiry into the nature of this phenomenal world. That is the foundation of modern science and technology. But in Vedantic philosophy, it goes deeper. It says the world is our creation. The way we view the world is what it is for us. Therefore, it's our own creation. That means the seeing the world, the perceived world, depends upon the perceiver. The seeing objects and their nature, their ontological existence is dependent upon the seer, the perceiver. Frequently, this idea is defended on the basis of our dream experience. And after that, I will come straight to Nasadiya Sukta. See, in dream, at least we know very well it is a creation of our own mind. Mind projects all the phenomena that we experience in dream. We may be sleeping in a dark, tiny room. We may be dreaming, maybe riding an elephant under the broad sun, which is impossible. Different space, different place, everything. So dream is essentially a projection of our memories by the mind. So waking state experiences, empirical experiences are also not different. They are the projection of our own mind, the way we interpret the emotions and feelings and culture and traditions that we employ. That's what actually makes the world for us. So that much about this. Now we will come to the sutra proper. So, one important significance of this sutta is it's one of the very, very few Vedic hymns that Swami Vivekananda directly spoke of and expounded in his own language. He was trying to explain this, to project the idea of the whole creation, the whole existence coming out of one and manifest reality, which again is built upon one absolute reality. I mentioned this, I had to mention this in the last Yoga Sutra classes. One point, remember, is in Vedantic cosmology, we believe that life, our experiences at the ordinary individual level, and also the entire cosmos, universe, they move in cycles and not in a straight line. This is a central principle to be understood when we think of Nasadiya Sukta. That means our own experiences, what we see, is a replay of our karmas, the results of our actions in previous life. which get modified through further actions. And again, we accumulate new samskaras, new vrittis, new impressions through new actions. And accordingly, we are born again with this baggage, which contains samskaras, impressions, tendencies, which are good, which we like, and also those which we do not like, both positive and negative. It is baggage with which we are born. That's why we feel a great inclination to or attraction to a certain higher ideas in this life. Without any background in terms of bringing up domestic or family environment or anything, still there are people who take to some strange, noble ideas and dedicate their whole life for this. Think of a man like Max Müller, who was born in an entirely different culture and tradition, and was commissioned by the church to publish Vedas so that the whole world will understand what absolute gibberish Vedas constitute. And this man, after he started reading the Vedas, he never looked back. Rest of his life, and not only he and his wife, he was a married man. And they lived like sages, like ancient sages, as Vivekananda calls them, Vedic sages, reincarnate. They spent their whole lifetime to study the Vedas, to think of it. That's the whole lifetime. They would look back. And this happened not only to Max Müller, and to many others, Paul Dusen, MacDonald, who's an Englishman, quite a few, Bidenitz, Keith, quite a few. I don't have the whole list right now in front of me. So why? So all these experiences in the form of memories and impressions, they come back again. And you go on evolving in spiritual life. Again, you come back. So birth, life, rebirth, the cycle continues. These are the individual level. At the cosmic level, from this unmanifest state, the cosmos, the universe emerges. And maybe after several trillions of years, it may go back to the unmanifest state, which cannot be called this or this not, cannot be called existence or non-existence. And again, after maybe trillions of years, they manifest again. So this involves not only this earth, it involves all that we can think of. So it is called a cyclicism, going through cycles of creation, dissolution, and rebirth. Dissolution doesn't mean destruction. It means the effect going back to the cause. That's why the tree is going back to the seed. That's why when you plant it, the seed emerges, evolves into a tree. That's why you put one seed, only that kind of tree will come up. Because the seed was the tree, and the tree gets involved in the seed. So it starts evolving. Taking name and form, the subtle becoming gross called evolution. When we think of this gross as pre-existing in the subtle cause, it is called the involved state, involution, as we call it. So creation in Veda, in Vedic tradition, Nasadiya Sukta, is not manufacturing something. Well, you know, you may say a pot maker makes a pot. But actually, what he does is, he collects mud, and then he uses some instruments, and he just adds two things to that mud through this process, name and form. And you got a pot, different pots, different utensils made of the same soil. You break it, it goes back to the mud. You melt the golden ornaments, they go back to the gold. Like that, involution is nothing but the gross going back to the subtle. And evolution is nothing but a subtle manifesting. Manifesting is a clear meaning, nama, rupa, and causation. Name, form, and causation. Nama is the name. Suppose you have got 10,000 ornaments of the same shape and size and weight. There is no need of more than one name. But suppose you have got 10,000 different ornaments, different shapes and sizes and quality, then you need 10,000 names. Like that, the same thing, when they assume different forms, they will have to assume different names, rupa and nama. And they have a cause, just a kind of becoming the cause, becoming the effect. But really speaking, this is only at the empirical level. So this Nasadiya Suktam projects not the idea of creation, to be more precise, is the idea of projection. So the subtle manifesting as different names and forms, you call it projection. And that projected thing going back, the subtle, is called dissolution. Maybe after trillions of years, they may come back. So a Vedic sage will tell you, that's why he said, Sado Bendham Asadi Niravindan Kriti Pradeshya Kavayo Manisha. Where do you look for the cause? Not on the planet. You have to look for the cause within your own heart. And that absolute reality, as Atman, it exists at an immanent reality within all of us. And it exists as the all-pervading reality everywhere. It is also the transcendental. Transcendental in the sense it can be perceived or conceived of at the empirical level. That's what it means. So the first sutra, mantra is this. As I mentioned, you know, Nasadasi, Nosadasi, Tadanim, Nasid, Rajo, No, Vyoma, Paroyat, Kimavari, Vakkuha, Kasya, Sharma, Nampa, Sharman, Ampa, Kimasid, Gahanam, Gibhiram. This is the first one. This was, we chanted, you heard my chanting. So, the beginning itself, the great Sayanacharya who lived the 13th century, he wrote a magnificent commentary. An interesting thing is, we have to remember, if today a great evolutionist or a great Indologist or linguist like Max Muller or a philosopher like Paul Deussen reads this and find this great meaning and they try to find this is so absolutely rational and scientifically quite logical, it's because a great man wrote a commentary to all these verses in the 13th century AD. His name was Sayanacharya. And he wrote a commentary for all the four Vedas. And where he was a great follower of Shankaracharya, belonged to that tradition. So many of these mantras are part of the Upanishads which Shankaracharya commented upon. So wherever those portions came up, he just copied, more or less reproduced Shankaracharya's interpretation. So all the Upanishad, many of the Upanishad mantras, for example, in the Muntaka Upanishad, Dua Suparna, Soija, Sakhaya, you know, all these are Upanishad mantras. So when Shankaracharya wrote a commentary in 8th century, 7th, 8th century AD, he wrote a very profound commentary on all these Upanishads on the basis of Advaita philosophy. Sayana came almost 400 years, 500 years later. He was also a monk of the same tradition, of the a philosopher of the same tradition. So he just reproduced Shankaracharya's commentary. So he says, Sustihi Prag Avastha Nirastha Samastha Prapanchayaha Pralayavastasa Nirupide. He said the first verse is an analysis of what is called Pralayavastha. Pralaya Pragarshena Liyadeidi Pralaya. What is Pralaya? Pralaya, if you read ordinary Sanskrit apte or Moni Williams, you find floods. It is not floods. Floods not in the sense, maybe more or less such ideas of everything existing in subtle form you may find in the Old Testament also, whenever there is a reference to a kind of state where everything was merged in something and slowly things coming out. Could be, but I'm not going into those details. So here he says, before creation, Means before the emergence of all these in names and forms, there was a state. That state was pralayavastha, which means it is subtle, unmanifest state. Unmanifest means before this avyakta state emerged and evolved, in terms of names and forms, there was such a thing which cannot be called as existence or non-existence. Tadanim pralayadashaya avasthitam yas dasya jagato moolarakshanam tat asit na asit sasavishanava nirvakyam nasit. So there was no nothingness, that's what it means, no nothingness, like the horn of a hair. There's nothing which is total, absolute, intellectually inconceivable. But there was something which was subtle. Again, he says, the verse continues, and no sadasid, and also there was nothing that could be empirically understood. So that reality could not be called as real in the empirical sense or unreal in the empirical sense. Now, let us look at Swami Vivekananda's translation. He put it in a very philosophical, or he was himself a poet. He says, existence was not then, nor non-existence. The world was not, the sky beyond was neither. What covered the mist, of whom was that? What was in the depths of darkness, thick? Death was not then, nor immortality. The night was neither separate from day, but motionless did that vibrate alone with its own glory, one beyond that nothing did exist. So, this is Swamiji's analysis. At first in darkness, hidden darkness lay, undistinguished as one mass of water. Then that which lay in void discovered, a glory did put forth by tapa. So, creation is somewhat implied, you know. There's a very interesting concept here. How did this world, universe emerge from this unmanifest state? What triggered the evolution of this unmanifest state to slowly evolve into manifest world which consists of plurality, different things with different names? So one important idea is meant, tapa is mentioned. Tapa actually, A.L. Basham translates it heat. Tapa is actually literally heat, but it is something else. You get hot about something, that is tapa. It is not the heat of the sun or the flame. When you think, when you turn your eyes, your mind, and your senses inward, and when you undertake a journey in search of that truth, once you realize that truth within you, then your sankalpa, your will becomes a visible empirical reality. As I mentioned, what we see is what we have in our mind. So can we produce an empirical objective reality through mere will? Great sages could do that. Or this spiritual reality from which everything emerges could do that by will. But it's not just will. It is creation not with a purpose, because that would make the creator imperfect. If you have a purpose for which you create the world, then you cannot say much about it, because you won't feel much admiration for anyone who creates a world like this. You know, this is not a very pleasant thing to live in. So that's one of the reasons why agnostics and atheists don't have much to say in admiration of a transcendental creator God, whether in Hinduism, Christianity, or any tradition. But Vedic sages did not deny that. But they said, it's true, you can think of the world being created by somebody. But as you go deeper in your own search inward, then you find the real cause is within ourselves. So once we realize the truth within through meditation, the word, so tapa is used. It's a symbolic metaphor. It's a metaphor which means through intense meditation. From desire arose the primal seed of mind. The sages have seen all this in their hearts. Sato bendum asadu niravindan kriti padishya kavyo manisha. The sages discovered this within themselves. Sifting existence for non-existence, it raised above, below, and sideways spread. So I will come back to the sutra again. Now coming to the next one. Namrutirasit amrudannatarhi. There was no death then. Amrita means there was no deathlessness. No sun, no moon, no day, no night. Anidavadam sudhayatatekam tasmadhyanyat parakinchanasa. Na parakinchanasa. But he says this. So, there was no death, no deathlessness. No days and no weeks, no months, no concept of time. So here, this is the first great statement in the Vedic literature, which talks about a time beyond and before time. Time can be conceived of only in relation to something. That's the, there should be something that should we should be able to relate to when we talk about time. In our own life, at a universal level, you know, the sun, the moon, the sunrise and moonrise, or the seasons, months and weeks and years, these are different attempts on the part of human mind to analyze time. So, but this unmanifestate belonged to a time that existed before time emerged. Because there was nothing in this world you can enjoy, you can analyze in terms of existing at empirical level, like being born, or non-existing at empirical level. So there was no sun, no moon. But it was certainly not nothingness or absolute non-existence. It was not absolute non-existence. It was something which you cannot describe beyond description, beyond explanation. See, you can explain something. When we try to explain, whatever attempt we make to explain something, we use our mind, our intelligence, our intellect. And we associate what we try to explain with something that we already are familiar with. That's how we explain. There was nothing. Therefore, it was something which cannot be just beyond explanation, beyond words, beyond understanding. Because explanation is possible only when there is time and death. So the verse is this: Namrtirasit Namudam Natarki Nadatriya Anna Asit Prakeda. Anidavadam sudhayatadegam. Here's a very interesting statement is there. There was something existing. There was something existing which was moving, but not the way we understand movement in this world. That apo va idam agre sarilam asid. This statement in the Sainacharya comments. You cannot say it was totally beyond explanation. We cannot understand, comprehend. It is not beyond comprehension. It is beyond our comprehension. It could be comprehended when you turn the inquiry inward. So, when you turn the inquiry inward, then as we evolve in spiritual life, we are able to understand this something which is beyond understanding. Tama asit tamasa gunnam agre prakedam sarilam sarvama idam. Srishte prak ആത്മതത്വസ്യ അവരോധ മായ പരസംജ്ഞം ഭാവരൂപാത്മക അന്ധ ആസീത്. ഇക്കൊണ്ട് മായ, ദ വേർഡ് മായ ഈസ് ഹിയർ. മായാപരസംജ്ഞം, മായ ഈസ് എ വെരി ഇൻട്രസ്റ്റിംഗ് വേർഡ് ഇൻ വേദാന്ത ആൻഡ് ഓൾസോ ഇൻ ദ ഡിസ്ക്രിപ്ഷൻ ഓഫ് ദിസ്. യു ഫൈൻഡ് ടു വേർഡ്സ് ആർ മാ ആൻഡ് യ. യ ഈസ് ആക്ച്വലി എ പ്രൊനൗൺ ഇൻ സാൻസ്ക്രിറ്റ്, ഇൻ ദി സ്ത്രീ ഫെമിനിൻ ജെൻഡർ. യ സ്ത്രീ, സ്വയം, സുകൃതി, നമ്മളേക്ക് ഫൻ യ. And ma, even used with certain other verbal formations, it has a negative meaning. It negates the meaning. Ma gachchudu, don't come here. Don't go there. Ma gachchudu, don't come here. Ma gachchudu, don't go there. Like that. Ma vadudu, don't speak. So it actually negates. So here there is a pronoun and a negating factor combined. So you cannot have a pronoun when you refer to something which is total non-existence. There should be something to relate to. Then only use a word, a pronoun, this, that, all of that. But it cannot be absolute reality. So to imply that it is not the absolute reality, it is not the absolute reality, it is not absolute unreality either. To imply this, the word ma is used. I mean to rule out the possibility of interpreting this relative entity as something absolute. So the word negating aspect element is used, ma. It is not absolute unreality. To emphasize that point, ya is used. Ya is a pronoun. Ya implies the existence of something at some level, empirical level. Ma means the possibility of ruling out the interpretation that it is the absolute reality. It is not absolute reality. It is not absolute unreality either. So this was what existed in the beginning. So you find here, interestingly, our understanding of the origin of the universe in a way depends upon our own spiritual journey into ourselves. Okay, then I shall come to the last one because we don't have just enough time. It takes a longer time. I shall come to the last one, and that comes with a very profound statement. Iyam visishtihi yada abhuva. So this creation, it is so, or what it means, the evolution from this unmanifest state to the manifest state of names and forms, it is so incomprehensible. In the sense, it cannot be logically understood. It cannot be analyzed by reasoning or logical association. So, visushti yada abhuva, yadi va dheya, yadi va na. So, there should be somebody, some force, some mighty, mysterious power behind all this. Asya ya ati akshaka means a definition called Ishwara. So there should be Ishwara here, doesn't mean a creator God. Ishwara here means something that controls and regulates, still transcending everything, the absolute reality. I mean to substantiate the early statement that the world or universe cannot evolve from absolute unreality or nothingness. There was something. And that something we'll realize when we turn the inquiry inward. So in other words, instead of looking for answers in external inquiries, in inquiries into nature, phenomenal world, we should turn the inquiry inward, and as we evolve in spiritual life, we find the real answers within ourselves. So the answers are not outside, the answers are within ourselves. And when we get this answer, then that answer cannot be countered. It doesn't come from reason. It doesn't come from logic. It is our own experience. So on the one hand, it is a very profound explanation or description of the cosmos, and also is a description of our own spiritual journey in search of our own true nature. As we evolve, As we go deeper and deeper into our own true self, we find answers within ourselves. So maybe on another occasion, we'll continue the discussion on the same hymn. Right now, I should only time. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti Harihi Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.